Okay, that's what's going on. Now I grew up down an old dirt road in a town you wouldn't know. My pops picked the place up for 1500. What's up, Wisconsin? Welcome to Raised in Wisco with Joel Clayfish and Danielle Fairman. Man, Wisconsin is a hunting fool of a state right now. I'm telling you, I had in 4 days the Wisconsin trifecta. I shot a huge buck that ended up scoring 142. I'm so excited. I was in the back 40 on the property we own, and there are very few things in life more satisfying than harvesting something on your own property. I'm telling you. And then the next day, I shot a banded duck, my first banded duck.
I did not know this one.
No, I have several goose bands. But
you do.
If you're watching on Facebook Live, and check us out on Facebook Live, you can see I'm wearing my lanyard because I just came from the duck field tonight. We got 31. We had 11 guys, got 31 green heads and one black duck, and it was beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
So I had a banded duck the next day, and then 2 days later, I shot a turkey. And we had plenty to eat over the Thanksgiving holiday, and that was super.
That sounds like
awesome.
A great Thanksgiving feast right there.
Yeah, it was great.
A little bit of everything.
You know, this has been an unbelievable year for ducks. Sometimes it works out in Wisconsin and better than others, but we have been crunching the ducks. And the best part about that for me is I get to eat duck every day. I'm on this.
Oh, gosh, yes.
I had this come to Jesus meeting, Danielle. Danielle Fairman, former co-star of Kill It, Clean It, Cook It. Now we're co-anchors, co-hosts of Raised in Wisco, which is fantastic. But you eating, I'm so jacked. I've been eating duck like every day. And I had this come to Jesus meeting with my doctor where she told me like I had to switch things around or I'll be dead.
What?
Well, yeah, she basically said.
Nonchalant conversation. He's like, well, I should be, what?
Well, she basically said that, you know, you're getting
transition.
Old, Joel, and you better switch some things up and lose some weight and get in shape and eat right and exercise. So
a duck salad.
Oh, yeah, but lots of protein. You're supposed to eat lots of protein if you want to be healthy. So we've been eating a lot of duck. Before we get into the show tonight, I want to say hey to our the Kennedy clan out in Oconomowoc, our loyal listeners. Robin's out with the flu right now. Influenza
Robin?
A, I think. So it's hitting a lot of people right now.
Robin,
thank you. I know you're listening, though. And Dan, hey, what's up? And Aiden and all the rest of your family.
Drink some water,
thanks
Robin.
For listening. And the Hughes, thanks for the Hughes down in Janesville. Thank you for hosting that hunt today. It was absolutely fantastic and beautiful. We are right in the middle of the Wisconsin muzzleloader season for deer. Do you have a muzzleloader, Danielle?
No, I do not have a muzzleloader.
You know, as far as firearms are concerned, they're fairly inexpensive to buy, or at least they used to be. They're getting up there now with Bideflation, but did I say that?
I heard
it's
nothing.
Okay. But a couple weeks ago, we had a guest who's what I would call the deer whisperer, a deer expert. I mean, he's got, you know, 30 deer, 30 bucks on his wall, over 150 inches.
Little mini Cabela's inside.
He's got a father who is a record holder for Jefferson County for large deer, and he's fascinating. We got into a conversation about hunting deer and hunting big deer, and we couldn't cover 1/100th of what Paul House was going to impart on us. And we've got Rob Brennecke in the studio with us too today. And we're going to talk about patience in deer harvesting and
patience.
And some of the tough. Well, I think that's maybe why I'm not the greatest whitetail hunter. But first off, Paul, welcome back to the show.
Hello, Paul.
Thank you. Thank you. Pleasure being here.
Thank you for being here as well.
My pleasure.
I can see you seem so excited. Perfect. Paul, we are right in the middle of the muzzleloader season. Muzzleloading, you know, black powder rifle hunting used to be this very difficult thing.
Yes.
Now the current muzzleloaders are damn near like a rifle, you know, but you
absolutely
get one shot.
Yep.
First of all, you've put deer on the wall, most of them with archery equipment, correct?
Yep, or a muzzleloader. So I actually shot my buck this year with a muzzleloader. I'm very, very confident with my muzzleloader. In fact, I will shoot that over a rifle believe it or not, any day they drive tax if you if you get them tuned in. Oh yeah.
What are you shooting? What kind are you shooting?
I shoot a Knight, and then I do have a Thompson Center Encore too, and I've got them dialed in. I shoot White Hots, which is the propellant, and then I shoot Barnes 250 grain, and they are just devastating. And I at 200 yards, I can shoot a two inch circle with them.
What?
Yeah. Wow. Mine was 170 when I shot him, and I put it right behind his rib. It was quartering away, and that's right where I hit him. And wow. The guy that cleans my deer, Matt, which is my project manager. Thanks, Matt. he actually found my slug, and it was amazing to see how well those performed and how they mushroomed. It was incredible to see the devastation.
You're shooting a 50 caliber?
Yep, 50 caliber. Yep.
That's crazy.
It was just like you took a paint pail and just dumped it. I mean, it was just unbelievable, the blood trail, and that thing was dead in 60 yards.
And, you know, and some people think, oh, ew, that's horrible, but that's actually what ethical killing is about.
Absolutely.
We, you know, we've had this debate before. You go to the store, you're buying an animal that was born to be raised to be killed. Mm-hmm. And when you harvest from the field, you're killing an animal that's lived a free life and gets whacked one day and ends up on the dinner table. I argue
absolutely,
a much more ethical way to put food on the table. But also, you still want to be cognizant as a hunter about the most ethical way to take down your animal. No,
absolutely.
No question. Every animal you kill, mm-hmm. you want it put out of its misery as quickly as possible. And then you can take that from the field to the table. One thing, so Rob Brennecke is a good friend of mine, and he's here in the studio with us. He has been a hunting buddy of mine as long as he's been a friend. And what's fascinating to me, and I think that a lot of people don't take into consideration, especially when they look at somebody like you who takes deer hunting as a science, a real science. I made a joke with my brother-in-law about that, you know, your monitoring of deer, it's like walking into a security expert at a major right. corporation. You got panels, you're watching cameras. It's a science to you. There's
it
no
is.
Question about it.
No questions.
Routes, food sources, mineral content, everything. It's a science to you. But even to you, it is a science. And you say, well, that guy's got it dialed. It's a science. He goes out and he kills his deer. I think people still completely underestimate the role of patience.
Absolutely.
In deer hunting.
I agree.
And I think that's one of the reasons I'm not a great hunter. I'm not a great whitetail hunter because I don't have that kind of patience. But Rob's been hunting.
Yes. Yes, he has.
And he's been putting he has really been putting in his time. And so first, Paul, talk to me about the role of patience in whitetail hunting. And then, you know, by comparison to other types of hunting.
Absolutely. So, I mean, definitely, I mean, I have lots of people ask me, you know, what's your success or what's your key to success? And I always use the one word, impatience. And when you're hunting these big whitetail, they are very, very in tune to their surroundings. They also do not, very seldom do they do the same thing day in and day out, especially when you get into the older, mature ones. They're using different travel corridors. They're using different bedding areas. I really don't see them bed in the same spot all the time. So getting into your brain that, you know, you have to just, you know, get, I mean, I'm bell to bell when I sit. Doesn't matter if it's, you know, it doesn't matter if it's middle of October or if it's, you know, late season in December, deer have to get up and feed five times in a day. And the colder it gets, obviously, the more they'll move around. So when you're in your stand, just that mental note of replaying that deer coming down that trail or coming out of the wood line or whatever it might be, and just constantly playing that over in your head, excuse me, really allows me to sit in my stand all day. I'm a very impatient person when it comes to everything else, you know? I mean, I can't sit still. I pace when I talk on the phone. I mean, it's like go, go, go. But when it comes to deer, my wife asked me, how can you sit in that tree stand for 11 hours and not move a muscle? And it's just one of those things. I know that eventually that deer is going to walk by that spot. And as long as you play your wins, do your things right, and you have that patience, you will get an opportunity at that deer that you are hunting.
Danielle, how are you with patience?
when it comes to hunting, yeah, pretty good, but
for deer hunting.
For deer hunting,
do you,
yeah,
sit belt up? Have you ever sat,
oh, yeah,
from the beginning till the end of the
as
day?
As long as I have my snacks, I'm good.
Well,
yeah, absolutely, I have.
I can honestly tell you I've never done it. And the reason you described is because I'm that guy who can't sit still. Now, I will tell you, from the beginning of my hunting until now, I've gotten a lot better at it. I mean, I'll sit and watch a movie on my phone with my iPods.
Absolutely.
In, which is,
yeah,
you know, to pass some time. And I've gotten better about anticipating the potential for something to happen. But I think part of that is creating an environment around yourself that you know something could happen. If you're sitting in the middle of some crappy spot,
mm-hmm,
and nothing's going to happen, it's a lot,
right,
harder to sit there. Or if you walk in and some you know, bozo's been tromping around the property you're going to sit on,
well, oh, that, yeah, no, that, patience, then
that puts your mental, that changes your mental state.
Absolutely.
Because you know there's a lot less of a chance that you're going to have to harvest anything or something's going to walk,
well,
through.
Well, like we talked about before in other episodes, is when you sit out in the woods, it's when, like, you find your most peace, though, too.
Right.
Because I use it for something completely different. Yeah, that deer,
yes,
could be walking past, but I know I'm, like, recentering myself. Like, sitting out there, having nobody to talk to, nothing to do except,
oh,
for sit,
absolutely,
there.
Oh, absolutely.
And the only worry I have is Bandit. I'm like, oh, does Bandit need food and water? And I look at my little camera. Oh, yep, he's good. And I'm like, okay, back.
Huh.
I love sitting out there, just unless it's absolutely freezing. But
I also think that every human being has limits as to how much they can take of solitude.
Yeah.
I think that we are a social, human beings are a social creature. And I think that there are points at which you start even getting in your own head when you're hunting. Because I'll sit there longer turkey hunting than I will deer hunting, which is bizarre to most people.
Yes, that is a little bit bizarre. I mean, one thing I will tell you, too, that's really interesting,
that's,
and I was thinking
bizarre
about this. So, watching your surroundings and how the other wildlife, you know, interacts and how their movements are, and, like, there's certain key things, like blue jays. Blue jays will alert you if something walks into your area, you know, whether that be a coyote or a deer or a person or whatever, they squawk. Same thing with squirrels, things like that. But there's other subtle animals that will give you signs and stuff that something's going on around you. And watching all of the wildlife as a whole, like, I know if I'm going to see deer, I'll be up in the tree, and I know if there ain't a stitch of anything moving around anywhere, it's like, you know, the pressure's low, they're just not moving, everybody's hunkered down.
Okay, hold that thought. We got to go to break, because then we're going to come back and talk to Rob about how much he's sat most he has in his life. We'll be right back on Raised in Wisco with Joel Clayfish and Daniel Fairman. You're listening to 540 AM WAUK 101 FM, The Shaw. This is Raised in Wisco with Joel Clayfish and Danielle Fairman. Give us a holler if you like, 844-967-2789, 844-967-2789. Going into the break, we were talking with Paul House, expert deer hunter, deer whisperer.
A guru.
About patience in the stand, and above and beyond all, when it comes to killing whitetails, it's a matter of how long you can sit there. Rob Brennecke, you're joining us today. We've been hunting buddies for a long time. We've hunted a lot of waterfowl together. We've sat for turkeys maybe and deer a couple times. What have you put more time in this year deer hunting than you ever have?
I have.
What you kind of have, Paul's been mentoring you. Is,
yes,
that a good way to put it?
Yes. He's been taking me out, showing me the ropes, and it's been a wonderful experience.
How is it? Now, you don't strike me as the most patient guy in the world.
I am not a patient guy. Not one bit.
So quick to answer.
I am a pacer, a walker, Can't sit in my layout
over
blind.
In a shaker.
Yeah. You can't sit in your layout blind either.
Oh, for about I'm good for no, about 45 minutes.
Me nuts.
Really?
He walks around. I'll be like, "There's birds." If you think for 1 minute that when the birds come over the horizon and they see 10 people running back to their blinds, that they're not wary right off the bat, and then you wonder why they don't finish in the decoys because they saw you. That drives me batty. When people are walking around, oh, we can get in, we can get in. Well, yeah. But if you're jumping in when they're coming, they're not going to finish. Oh, that drives me nuts.
Hey, we're not jumping anymore at our age. We're no. kind of one leg
sauntering
down, kind of sliding in. It's there's nothing.
Hold on, I got a cramp.
There's nothing fast about it.
No, it just drives me nuts, people who sit out of their blind when we're bird hunting. But that's a different topic for a different show. How much time have you sat this year?
Between bow hunting and gun hunting, I don't know, probably. I guess if I figured out in hours, maybe 100, 150 hours.
Oh, yeah. Nice.
Holy cow.
Probably.
Yeah.
That's pretty wow. darn impressive yeah. for your first year really taking it very seriously. That's a lot. Is it driving you nuts? I know your mentor's here, so you gotta be careful of what you say.
Right.
But
is it too bad?
We're on the show. Let it all out.
No,
don't hold back.
It's you know the first day was tough. I'll be honest. When we sat bell to
the
bell,
the first day.
Yeah, it was really hard. It was cold. It was tough. I'll give you that. I wanted to get down, run around. You don't just
warm up.
Warm up.
Get something to eat.
Texting Paul.
Should I get out?
Like the opener. Like the opener of Gun. Like that Saturday was absolutely freezing.
Yeah, it was cold. Mm-mm. So, have you seen deer?
Yes, I've been sitting this year. I have seen a lot of deer.
I think Paul. Don't you think that it helps? When you're hunting, even if you're out, even if you're targeting a big buck, don't you think it helps quite a bit if you're seeing other wildlife?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it keeps your mind going. But the biggest thing I will tell you is the areas where I kill my big deer, I don't see a lot of deer. It's a mental game because remember, big bucks do not live with the rest of the deer herd.
Huh.
So
tell me talk about the mental game. How do you overcome that mental game? I sit in that tree stand, and if I'm half hour past opening light, I like the golden hours, right? Mm-hmm. The front and the end of the day. That's when I'm super excited. I feel like as soon as that first half hour, 45 minutes goes by, I feel like I'm wasting my time.
I'm usually still in bed.
You I don't did even say get out into
the
time.
Yeah, I don't even get out into my tree until 8:30, 9 o'clock, especially during the month like the 5th through the 12th of November. I get everybody going, I'll hang out at the office, and then I go sit after that. It's just like I said, it's a mental game. And because I have learned that over the years and killed, I would say, 80% of my big deer in the middle of the day. It's a lot easier for me. It's really hard for other people. And that's just one of them things where I know it's going to happen. It's not a matter of if, it's just a matter of when. And all of the big ones that I have passed this year, in fact, the one I shot with my muzzleloader was at 1 o'clock in the afternoon. So it's just one of them things that you use. It's a mental thing. It really, really is. And knowing that, playing that over in your head, knowing at any moment he can walk down the trail. But obviously, when I was on the TV show, you know, we spent 45 days bell to bell in the tree. Didn't matter if it was raining.
That's a lot.
Oh, yeah. It didn't matter. Rain, sleet, snow. I mean, my partner and I, which was my best friend from high school, Chris Bailing, which is nicknamed Slimer. That's a whole other story we can get into. But him and I were so dedicated to it. We learned so much. And just doing that, you learn. And when we started killing most of our big deer in the middle of the day, him and I would look at each other like, you know, geez, it's 12:30, you just shot a freaking giant. We're down in Illinois, you know, it quits raining, clouds clear up, and all of a sudden, boom, he's like, here comes a shooter down the trail, and it's a freaking...
At noon.
It was 8x5, just a freaking giant. So... And that, knowing that, then going, why, keeping notes, we kept a lot of notes. I have a logbook that, you know, people would die for. But, you know, writing down pressures, wind, you know, cloud clearing, all these things and putting that all together. But the biggest common denominator that we found was that most of the deer, the big deer during them certain times of the year were midday movers, you know?
That's crazy. Nobody thinks of it that way.
No, everyone leaves like around 10 o'clock, goes to lunch, comes back around 2.
Absolutely. And you can kill big deer like that, don't get me wrong, mm-hmm. but when you're hunting, especially in high-pressured areas and things like that, you know, you're going to get into them deer that they understand that. They're not stupid, you know? So it's definitely a mental game. It really is, because most people can't sit bell to bell. And I will agree with Rob, even for me, the first day or two, me sitting bell to bell, it's a challenge. And then once your body gets used to it, you know, because it's like you really can't practice to sit still for 11 right. hours because yeah. your life doesn't allow you to do that. So
your wife will wonder what the hell you're doing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. When we come back, we're going to talk about the difference between gun season and other seasons in Wisconsin and what we need to do to prep for that. You're listening to Raised in Wisco on 540 AM WAUK. Welcome back. My daughter likes to hunt turkeys because she thinks they're a little bit easier than white-tailed balls. So.
I agree.
But it does, to me, as a dad, I do not care. I do not care what my daughter hunts or what she likes to hunt or doesn't like to hunt. I absolutely live for the time I get to spend in the field with my daughters.
Yep.
There's nothing better in the entire universe. We went into the break talking about, you know, some of the habits of deer and the difference between patterning them early versus late. And I want to ask you, what are the biggest differences as to your approach and as to folks' approach on whitetails from the archery season to the gun season to the muzzleloader season?
Well, I think obviously the archery season, you have the gift of being able to hunt, you know, the first rut that kicks off, which I call October's little mini rut, which is, you know, mid-October when you get them first older does that'll come into estrus and stuff. So, you know, you have that ability to be able to hunt, you know, some food sources, some green food sources and stuff that come gun season. You don't have that ability. You know, the crops are picked. Some of your, you know, greens are still palatable and stuff. But, I mean, I would think that definitely the bow hunting archery season, it gives you a longer time frame. It gives you, you know, nicer weather. So it gets a lot of people out so they can enjoy it without freezing their tails off like we all did on opening day. And as far as prep goes, you know, I mean, you're scouting totally different because now you're looking, you know, for them travel corridors when you're going to get into the ruts. You're looking for them doe bedding areas and stuff like that and trying to get in between the food sources and the doe bedding areas where them bucks are going to be traveling, looking and checking and looking for them receptive does. Come gun season, we're normally into what we call lockdown, which we're in the peak breeding cycle, which is, you know, peak estrus and, you know, we run around the 19th to the 25th around here. Of course, every farm and every doe herd and doe group are different. One farm, they'll lock down on me. It'll be 5 miles away. They'll lock down on me 5 days earlier than the other farm. It changes. But once you get into that time frame with your gun hunting, then patience really needs to play off because once them bucks pick them does up and they'll, you know, be with them for 36 to 72 hours, you have to be somewhere where they are, you know, going to be, if she does leave and come to a food source, he follows her. But you just have to be more patient and obviously have a longer range to shoot. So you can stay off of the areas a little bit, not penetrate them as much as you would have to with your archery equipment. So it does give you that advantage to even the playing field a little bit, but I mean, I guess that would be the, you know, the biggest things that I do. I change up my stand locations compared to gun hunting to bow hunting. And that's pretty much, I guess, in the grand scheme of things, what you can do.
Danielle, you've been quiet this show. You are. Are you soaking it in or? usually this quiet.
I'm not usually this quiet, no.
But you put a lot of hours in the stand this year. You bow hunt and gun hunt.
Mm-hmm. I have.
When you hear what Paul and Rob are talking about, with patience and having to change up your attack for deer, do you employ these things, or would you consider yourself more on my level, and that's like getting out when you can, in between hunting other things, in between the job, in between all that stuff?
Well, I have been thinking about where I'm hunting, the private land that I hunt, and every time we talk about this, I'm like, okay, where's the food source by where I hunt? And I'm like, oh, wait, that's miles away. Mine is more like a passerby. Like, the deer just come through, maybe taking a little nap, and then go away. Like, they don't stay there. They just pass through.
Yep.
I'm like, okay, well, where's the food? Where's the food be coming from? What if they get locked down so far away? Well, I'm screwed in this little one. Then I start thinking about public land.
Yep.
And I'm like, it's so much. I'm having a whole conversation in my head. I should be having it on the radio.
That's right.
I'm like thinking, like, where is this? Because where I hunt, it is lit. They just go through. I see new buck, new deer, like all the time.
Are there pass-through areas, Paul? What she's talking about? Are they just pass-through areas? They're kind of like hardwoods that are quiet hardwoods where they just know they're not going to be bothered. And so what kind of tack do you take in Danielle's situation? She's got a smaller plot to hunt.
Yep.
It's almost all hardwoods. I've seen it. I know it. I see deer there. A ton of deer.
There's deer there until.
Pasture spots are awesome. I mean, those are the ones where you get to benefit off all your neighbor's hard work. I mean, it's funny because I know guys that hunt areas like that, and they are really good. In those areas, what I would suggest is that you just write down, take notes, do your data, say, okay, this year I saw a buck on this day, this day, this day. Look at your weathers and stuff like that to say, okay, so next year I know that the deer are really moving through this area from this time of the month to this time of the month in October. And then in November, they're doing it here. And not waste your time any other times of the year and putting your scent in there. And the more you go in and out of a place is you're messing yourself up, right? Mm-hmm. So, excuse me. So taking that data down and spending the time and saying, okay, I know if I go in and hunt this, I mean, I have stands that I literally will not step foot in until November the 5th. And I want to it's even hard to this day, even though I know better. I mean, I'll get pictures of the big one in there. I know I can't go in there because if I do, he's gone. Once I get his brain, where his brain gets a little bit off of survival and gets on breeding, I know I have a little bit more of advantage. So keeping those things in mind, keeping track of them things and saying, okay, I'm going to go hunt this spot from this time frame to this time frame, I think would really help being successful instead of just going in there and spending as much time. Less is more sometimes in these situations. So that's why keeping logs and stuff. And if you've been able to hunt the land for a long period of time, even, 2 years, you can get enough data to get a good grasp on things.
What about
you can
from like a public mindset? So you only have public land, no private.
So public land is definitely something that is a challenge. Can you still kill big deer on public? Absolutely. No questions about it. But you run into all types, right? You run into people that think they own the public. You think you have people that just don't know what they're doing. They're out there enjoying it, which we all need to support each other, whether or not, everybody likes it. But the same thing with public land. It's like, okay, if everybody's going in and out of there and they're doing the same thing, you just go do the opposite. Right. So pay attention to when the vehicles are there, when they're leaving, all these things, and go, okay, well, there's nobody in here for this 4 hours or whenever it is a day. Well, then that's when you go in and hunt it. Right. Because obviously the deer, they're not going to be, they get really in tune to their surroundings really quickly. So that's one thing that I would, if I was going to hunt public again, which I did a lot, when I was younger, I would do that. For sure. And you'd be able to look for areas that are like, okay, this is a lot harder to get here. And most guys aren't going to go here. And you just have to put in that extra effort to get back a little bit farther.
Yep. The last year when I went to go hunt on public land, I found a neighbor close. I'm like, hey, I knocked on the door. I'm like, hey, can I, rent your driveway for October to December?
Yeah.
I'm like, oh, yeah, totally. So I just like
That's a perfect example.
Some casseroles, and they're like, yeah, just park here, and we'll stay over in the corner and just walk through. I'm like, ha ha.
That's awesome.
But then I only used it like twice.
I think sometimes we underestimate the goodness in people's hearts if you just ask.
Absolutely.
And a lot of life and a lot in life of what you get is just asking for it.
Yes.
And, you know, you have to be one of those people who says yes when people ask you, too, under certain circumstances. But you said less is more, and I think there's a mentality, or at least I have this mentality, that if I'm not putting my hours in, I don't deserve it to pay off. And less is more can kind of be counterintuitive to that, because you think, a lot of times I think, every spare second I have, I better be sitting in that tree stand or I'm not going to be successful. Mm-hmm. And I think, Paul, what you're saying is, when you do sit, sit your rear end off.
Yes.
But be careful about when you sit.
Exactly. And then it doesn't mean, just because you're not in the tree doesn't mean you're still not putting your time in, right? So you're scouting from afar, you're watching your cameras, you're paying attention to, you know, the winds and all your, you know, there's so many apps now with all this data and all these things, and you can still hunt from your desk, right? So when I fish bass tournaments, same thing. I do so much research and so much stuff from my computer. I go to a body of water.
You do bass tournaments too?
Yep.
Oh, dang.
And
nice.
And when I go to that body of water, I can get on fish right away because I've spent my time on my computer. So same thing. It doesn't matter. But knowing that, you know, going in and like I said, you know, you don't get many opportunities at mature bucks. You just have to really, really know when the right time is to go in there. You know, you will not know 90% of the time if a big buck notices you're in there or catches you in there. He's not like a doe. It's going to blow at you and snort at you and stomp around and look at you and everything else. Like, he's out of there. You have no clue.
He just might trot off and never come back.
All the time.
Oh.
All the time. I mean, I've bumped him before. There's one guy, though, that I read years ago. He would go in and he would purposely bump. You know the rule of thumb, you can bump them once, you bump them twice, it's over. This guy would go into these big marshes like the Jefferson Marsh, and he would literally walk through. He'd have a stand on his back, all of his gear, he'd walk through, and he'd bump a big buck. He would actually find a tree stand close to that bed, and he would hang his stand immediately, and that buck would come back 2-4 hours later, and he'd kill him.
Huh.
So,
really?
That.
Now, if he would have left the area, came back and bumped him again, that buck never would have came back, right? So it was just one of them things you can get away with that, you know. But it's just, like I said, you bump him once, okay, you bump him twice, game over, for sure.
You know, we were actually on a golf cart the other day to retrieve a deer.
Yep.
And we bumped an 11 pointer at one of the food plots on the way out to retrieve the deer.
Yep.
And my brother-in-law told his son, my nephew, he said, you should get in that stand right now and just sit there the rest of the day. And I think that kind of goes along with your theory that if you bump something, they don't quite know at first, but their instincts catch up very fast.
Yeah, and bumping deer in their sanctuary, in their bedding area, is different than bumping them off a food plot, too. You know, there's a big difference with that. Because when these bucks are in their bedding areas, it's because they haven't been messed with before. They know that those are really super safe areas. And like I said, they'll tolerate one time. If you go in and out of a food plot, he still has to feed. So if you bump him out of the food plot once or twice, he'll still come back to the food plot. He'll just turn nocturnal.
Sure.
Right? So those are kind of the differences. But if you go into where his safe zone is, his bedding area, right? So if you go in and you bump him out of there twice, now he's like, okay, this ain't safe. I got busted once.
I got to find a new safe zone.
Now, twice. Now I got to go move and go find something else somewhere else. So,
I think that this isn't exactly the same, but in Florida, when we run feeders for the hogs, for example, and, you know, they can feed deer down in Florida. A lot of places in the United States allow baiting.
Yes.
It's almost like they become accustomed to the ATV pulling up. It's almost like a dinner bell.
It is a dinner bell.
And so I think you made a very key point that bumping something from a food source is very different than bumping them in their natural habitat.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, it's definitely a totally different beast. Like I said, they know, I mean, they have Usually they'll have one or two entry routes to their bedding area, depending on the wind. And then leaving, they don't give a crap about the wind, believe it or not. I've watched so many bucks come out of their bedding with the wind to their back. Hmm. And it actually kind of floors me sometimes. Everybody's like, all the bucks use their wind. They're walking, you know, their nose into the wind all the time. And that's just so far from the truth. But I do know they do walk into their bedding area because they want to smell to see if there's a predator there waiting for them, right? But, you know, sometimes, like I said, I'll watch them. I've had numerous bucks that I've killed that they're coming to me. And, I mean, the wind is blowing right at their tail.
Right at them.
And, I mean, I got them. They're dead to rights, you know, because they can't smell me. So,
sure.
But it's different when they go into the beds. That's for sure. That's why it's really hard to hunt them in their bedding areas.
Okay, when we come back, can you believe it? The show's almost over. It goes so fast.
I don't understand how this hour goes fast.
I don't either. When we come back, we're going to talk about the rest of the season and what you should do to prepare if you want to hit those late season bucks. You're listening to Raised in Wisco with Joel Clayfish and Danielle Fairman on 540 AM WAUK. We're back in Wisconsin. I'm Raised in Wisco with Joel Clayfish and Danielle Fairman. Paul
First
House is in the house, along with Rob Brennecke, his mentee, his student. Is Paul your teacher, Rob, in buck and deer hunting and in life? Is Paul your teacher? Is Paul your mentor in life as well as in hunting?
Absolutely.
A life coach?
Is he your life coach? Do you ever go in and see Paul and he says, tell me how things are going? Does he have a couch that you lie down on?
Well, does he have a notepad?
We can the story of the coach. That's probably for another episode.
Should it be on it?
My question to you, Rob, is this is the first year that you've really, really dug into deer hunting. And if you said 150 hours, kudos to you, because I don't know that I could do that.
That's a lot.
Has it given you a new perspective on what deer hunting is? And has it grown a desire in you to get out there and get that quality buck?
Yeah, it has. I mean, I guess the first day I sat bell to bell with Paul, I did, you know, I saw a lot of does in the morning, and, you know, he always kept saying, you know, 10 to 2. So sitting there, you know, the first two best bucks I saw were between 10 and 2, like 12 and 1, actually. Huh. So it kind of puts that in your head that if I get out at 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock,
you're missing your opportunity.
What am I going to miss?
Yeah. How, Paul, has Rob been as a student?
Actually, very good. He's very open. He asks a lot of questions, which is the best thing you can do as a student. It's like you need to understand in your own way. So, you know, I have Rob set up on an area, which is it's about an acre and a half winter wheat plot next to some corn, some really great bedding areas. And I know that in this area, there is a couple good bucks with this. We have a really high doe population, which, I mean, you'll see 100 deer sometime during later in the season. So it makes it a little bit more challenging because the bucks don't have to get up and move on their feet a lot. But I wanted him to be into a spot to be able to see lots of deer, be able to watch their demeanor, watch how they interact with each other, and then watch their movements and kind of put all that stuff together. Plus, it keeps somebody that's just getting into it super, super tuned in, right? Because they're seeing stuff all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
I would never want to take Rob and be like, okay, Rob, let's go and go put him into one of my stands. I'm like, you ain't going to see crap, but if you do see one, it's going to be a good one, right? So, like my son, I'm like, Sam, if we go sit in this stand, you ain't going to see crap, but if you're going to see one, it's a big one. He's like, okay. And then he's like,
yeah, 2 minutes later, he's sleeping.
Yeah. Damn, but he shoots 155 incher. Then finally he's like, oh, you ain't kidding me.
That was such a bullwinkle.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, that sucker went straight out. That was so cool.
Oh, yeah.
What a cool deer.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was Stevie.
But my youngest son, Sam, last year shot a big one in a spot where I told him, you ain't going to see any deer except for a big one. And that's what he ended up shooting. So
nice.
That was Thanksgiving morning last year. But yeah, so it's, he's done really well. Obviously he gets a little bit of, you know, I get the phone call. Hey, do you think the deer are going to move today and stuff? And, you know, and when you get to the point of certain parts of the season, when we get into later into the gun season, you know, people don't understand like demeanors of deer and the way that they operate, it changes fairly quickly. You know, I'll hear guys, I'll watch Wisconsin rut report and stuff, and they'll be like, oh, the rut's on here. And then the guy's like, oh, I'm down in this county, I ain't seeing crap. And then, you know, you hear all this stuff go on. But typically during the rut stages, we'll say from the middle of October until your middle of November, I might get 2 days that are lights out where you're seeing 14 to 20 bucks, you know?
Hmm. Holy cow.
It's that just would be nice. Very, very, very minimal of when you see that constant rut activity, you know? It's just, you know, you get in over the hill country, Buffalo County, Trempealeau County, you know, Richland, stuff like that, where you have deer that are running benches and running ridgetops, and they're really kind of condensed down, per se, that you can, that they have to travel certain corridors and stuff. It's a little bit different. Here we're flatland, right? They can run wherever they want to. So it makes it a little bit different. But yeah, I mean, I think at the end of the day, I make we're gonna do some late season hunting, which I know you wanted to get into that a little bit. So that'll be I don't want to say easier, because nothing's easy when it comes to killing big deer, but once the bucks right now, from what I can tell from my cameras, they're in their rest mode, right? So I haven't really seen any deer over 2.5, 3.5 years old here in the last 4 or 5 days. So, you know, they're either locked up with their final does or they're resting. And once we start getting some super cold weather, you know, hunting them food sources are key. You know, your greens.
Is that when they start digging for the radishes and that type of stuff?
Oh, yeah. And it's all weather dependent. It's really interesting. So you'll watch when it gets a little warmer out, they'll go to the greens. They need both to sustain, right? Sure. They want the greens in order
to. So on the warmer days, hunt the greens.
Absolutely.
The radishes, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, if you get the a warming brassicas. Trend, brassicas, clovers.
I just wanted to say that.
I'm with you. And what's really interesting is that where really most people mess up late season hunting is that they don't understand that them deer bed super close to the food sources. Like
really?
Really close. So access, like
get out the crossbow.
Yeah. And I mean, I'll move my blinds like 50 to 100 yards into different spots so
does
I can
Danielle
access.
Does still have a chance in a pass through spot in late season?
Oh boy, it gets really, really tough in the late season.
Are unless you gonna hunt late season, Danielle?
I was going to, yes. I still haven't. There's no more venison in my freezer, so.
I mean, if you get,
I'm getting very, very low on duck.
Yeah.
But
well, acorn if flats gone with are good. Me
the other I day. Should have gone with you. I regret so many regrets.
You know what?
So many regrets.
I don't know. I have this bizarre feeling, Danielle, that if you put your time in yet this year, it's going to happen for you. I really do have that feeling.
We're going to get into our second rut here pretty dang quick. So.
And those pass-through spots are good during the second rut, yes?
Yeah, not. I mean, you're not going to see the ball. You're going to get the older, mature bucks that are gonna participate a little bit more. So, I mean, yeah, if you still have them, that doe herd or them doe groups in them certain areas and they haven't all
they're
been bred,
there,
absolutely.
Definitely.
Yeah, so, I mean, definitely, then it sounds like more of a bedding area. It's not like just a chunk of woods that nobody lives there and they just run back and forth. It sounds like there is some doe groups that live there. Mm-hmm. So there's always a chance, obviously, but, you know, hunting late season is, it becomes a challenge. It's one of my favorite times of the year. That's why, I mean, when I pick out a specific deer I'm hunting, I mean, I'll hunt all the way to the end of the year, and if I don't kill them with my bow, then I eat tag soup. It just is what it is. But,
but everything's good in the Instant Pot, Paul.
That'd be true. So much nicer if
Calvin,
I had
our producer, is the reason that this show runs so smoothly. He just gave me the 4 minutes, and we're done already. Holy cow. Calvin, are we turning you into a hunter in there? I mean, when you listen to this show, do you say to yourself, me as a person who's never hunted in their life, it might start thinking about it?
No, not really.
Okay. Well, Kelvin's really good at operating the board, so we'll just leave it at that. It's perfect. And that's it for our show already. And Paul, you're going to be a recurring guest because the stuff's fascinating. Thank you for listening out there. If you got topics you want to hear, let us know. For Danielle Fairman, I'm Joel Clayfish. For Paul House, Rob.